coming to you from the City of the Weird. Exploring topics from the esoteric and unexplored to dimensions unknown. Shining a light of truth on the darkest corners of our reality. Welcome to the Curious Realm.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to this special pre-recorded edition of The Curious Realm. As always with The Curious Realm, we bring you nothing but new content. We've never done replays, never done a best of episode, anything like that. Right now, I am currently horribly, folks, I'm sorry, I'm in Hawaii. So I'd love to say I'm at, like, suffering in Detroit on a corporate show or something like that. But I'm in a beach in Waikiki. Like, it's not horrible. I am currently bilocating myself across the globe. Our guest tonight, we have an amazing series of guests. Our guest in the second segment is Ryan Edwards, cryptozoologist out of San Antonio, Texas. We will be talking with him about the Gugwe and its relation to other cryptids such as Bigfoot, Dogman, things like that, what the relations are between those and how these cultural stories have led to even the creation and changing of cryptids into what they are modernly. So things like the Wendigo, stuff like that. So it'll be a great conversation with Ryan. In our first segment, we have the executive director of the newly relaunched International UFO Bureau, our good friend Terry Lynn Kell, is here. How are you doing today, Terry?
Hi, I'm doing thank you.
Well, it has been a little while since we have gotten to have you on the show. Give me just a second here. There we go. Hey, there she is.
Hi.
But it's great to see the International UFO Bureau restart. Whenever I worked with Mindy Topfest on the Hayden Hughes files and the archive and building that, that's when she really had the idea of, like, you know, I think I need to restart the Hayden Hughes International UFO Bureau. And it originally started in 1957 there in Oklahoma City. It was, of course, most famously known as the UFO Bureau where Jimmy Carter submitted his report and his sighting. So it's great to see it relaunch. I think it's especially with its new mission in mind, with using burgeoning technologies and including things like AI and stuff like that, I really think it's going to change the way a lot of the UFO field is done and the way that a lot of the research is done.
It absolutely will, because it is truly groundbreaking with investigations. And, you know, we're dedicated to preserving the truth behind unexplained encounters. And this is very new and different. We are illuminating the past, understanding the present, and guiding the future, literally. And today we blend decades of documented research with innovative technologies to really literally uncover the mystery surrounding all the phenomenon in ufology. And our mission is to provide, you know, comprehensive data-driven insight that inform public understanding and scientific exploration, along with global policy. And as we work to getting over a cold, and my darn throat every now and then gets me. As we're working to illuminate the past, understanding the present, and guide to the future, we literally are completely committed to all of what is happening within ufology. And you can read a little bit about us right there on our website, theinternationalufobureau.com. Everything is right there. And it's just a new concept. It's a new way of bringing about the conversation. And we were founded by Hayden Hughes, and he was involved in not just Jimmy Carter, but also there were other huge projects that he did. And by the way, he started while he was only 14 years old, and he was writing presidents. He was writing people that were returning his letters, and he was quite shocked himself. But this was what brought him into being and what has brought forth the Hayden Hughes files.
Yeah.
Let's see. I'm trying to remember the name of the guy. Sometimes I forget. that did the so many people died. Oh my gosh, isn't that funny that I can't remember that?
Oh,
right,
you mean Marshall Applewhite?
Yeah, thank you, Marshall Applewhite. Yeah, I just drew a blank right there.
Yeah.
He was somebody that Hayden was looking into, and he saw that they were going in a very wrong and dark direction. Yes, there you go, Heaven's Gate. And the away team, that's cute.
That was their actual patch.
I know. And what's so wild about it was they got off track, you know, and there's so many reasons why. But Hayden was wise enough to see that. He understood where they were going, you know, mentally. He could see their process, but understood this is not going in the right direction. And he pulled back. And I'm so grateful that he did.
Yeah.
And so grateful also, let me just throw that in there, that Mindy was able to acquire all of this. She was in the right place at the right time. And I believe it was divine intervention. Her, her relationship with Hayden's wife, after he had passed, she wanted this to go forth. And here comes Mindy, and it all worked out so beautifully. And it's been, like you said, from 1957, and he did die in 2017. And unfortunately, we were not able to meet him. What a loss that was, you know, and that's happening really a lot with a lot of, you know, people recently. I'm seeing that it's frightening how many people we're losing in ufology who have had contributed so much to
Absolutely.
This conversation.
You know, Terry, that is a lot of why I founded Curious Research. You know, for years I spent many, many years, as my audience knows, as a youth minister and involved with my Knights of Columbus group. And it always struck me whenever I would walk into a Knights of Columbus council as a younger guy. I mean, I'm 50 now, but it still happens. I walk in at 50 and people are buying me beer. I'm like, oh, keep this young buck around. It's like, man, I'm 50. You need 25-year-olds. You don't need me. I'm on your coattails as you retire, you know, like I'm like 10 years behind you. If we want this research, if we want these things to continue, we've got to find a way to bridge the generational gap. We've got to find a way to make these things. And it's not that ufology isn't interesting, folks. It's the science that for some reason is not sexy. It's not.
Yes.
You know, and we have to make it sexy. And nowadays, fortunately, with things like being able to utilize AI, stuff like that, that's a lot of what IFOUB is looking at doing, starting to integrate reports and past reports and other data with AI and find things in a different way. You know, start using it to cull information, which it's designed to do. So I think that's one of the most interesting things about IFOUB is the want to use AI, because so many are reticent to do that. And there really has been, and not just in ufology, between, you know, you know, you were formerly involved with MUFON. There are numerous, UFORC, all kinds of stuff out there that all kind of share the same watering trough, but for some reason splash the water all over each other while they're drinking, you know?
Right.
And there's not a reach across the aisle, let's share data mentality, which is what you need in science. It's almost like if Caltech and Harvard Caltech and MIT were both researching the same thing, but neither one of them would share data. Like,
exactly.
That's literally why we built the internet, was so that MIT and Caltech could share data.
Yeah.
You know?
That's
So I think that's a beautiful part of the IFOUB mission is building those bridges, bringing those communities together, because without that, it won't survive. You know, if we compartmentalize things, it's no less than the government at that point. We're compartmentalizing data and information in a field of study.
This is so true. And we are reaching out in many different avenues. One is our first responders initiative that we're doing.
Yes.
Dustin Hendricks, who is a master sergeant in Oklahoma City, he's the head of the police department, and he trains SWAT. and he's very integrated into the emergency response system. And, you know, yeah, if you go to special projects, you can read all about him. He's the International UFO Bureau is proud to superhead the First Responders Initiative. And it's a program designed to provide both police, fire, EMS personnel with a streamlined mechanism for reporting and investigating anomalous events.
That's right.
And so, you know, we also have what you're showing here, what you've got up on the screen, is also our voices that we're utilizing for the director of Indigenous Voices, Jonathan Redbird Dover. And in he's bringing forth so much information, and we're you know, partnering with all these different, you know, just to name a few, in all these different Indigenous peoples, they have so much information, and it's a part of the conversation. And I don't know why a lot of people are leaving that out, but they really have a lot of information that we are now connected with. And we have so many others. They're joining us at a really rapid rate. We're getting people calling us and wanting to be a part of what we're doing, the conversation, have a seat at this table, talking about all the different subjects and the understanding, the material that's been brought forth. Everybody wants to come together in teamwork, which never happened in this other place. It just never happened, which is why I resigned. You know, after 9 years, if it's not going to change, you know, you don't want to spend even another moment there. And there was no change. It was all going in the same direction. So this is really new and exciting, where we're working with others and open conversations, getting together, actually getting together with these people and bringing them in, as you well know.
I am in love with the Indigenous Peoples Initiative of IFOUB.
Yes,
honestly, the day that you and Mindy mentioned that to me, Mindy Topfest being the CEO, the day y'all mentioned that to me, I literally threw my hands up and rejoiced in my office because it's one of those. Whenever I spoke at the Remote Viewing Association this year, one of the things that I mentioned, as far as carrying this forward and carrying any topic abroad, doesn't matter if you're talking Bigfoot, doesn't matter if you're talking UFOs, doesn't matter if you're talking ghosts and the paranormal, is there an international language?
Right.
Like music is a prime example. If you know how to read music, you could go to China and swap a piece of music with a Chinese musician, and you can both play it with maybe a little personal inflection in there. But you're both going to play it pretty much the same way, because it's an international language. The symbols all mean the same thing no matter where you are. So when you're talking about an Indigenous initiative like this, the idea of making sure that, because, hey, nobody's saying that they haven't been asked. The question is, have they been asked in the right way?
Exactly.
Have we been asking the question, number one, in a non-confrontational way? Number two, in a way that is within the bounds of the Indigenous culture, so that they actively understand what we're asking, you know, because otherwise there may be things, there may be topics, there may be parts of it that historically they will not talk about and will not share. And culturally will not share with the outside, you know, so we have to get those languages down as far as definitions, what they mean, you know, all that kind of stuff, and understand the cross-cultural importance of these things.
Exactly. You know, the First Americans project that we're doing with IUFOB is deeply committed to honoring and literally preserving the voices of Native American communities through its First Americans project, which focuses on collecting and safeguarding traditional and contemporary reports of anomalous phenomenon occurring on tribal lands across all of the United States of America. And these efforts literally led the IUFOB vice chair, Michelle Miners, who is an amazing woman, in collaboration with the esteemed Navajo Paranormal Rangers, which is John Dover and Stan Milford. I'm sure you're familiar with them.
Absolutely.
They represent a unique and respectful approach to understanding the UFO and UAP phenomenon by working directly with tribal communities. So the Bureau aims to uncover centuries of knowledge and experiences rooted in Native traditions. And so this is so important. And we are so proud to be a part of this. Michelle is amazing, and her knowledge base. She's been on out at the Skinwalker Ranch. She's been on every popular TV, you know, station talking about these things, as John has as well. And they teach many different things where they are. So being a part of all of this together is just collaborating all of this information together. And, you know, you and I know that even the Bigfoot, you mentioned the Bigfoot, you know, issue. Why haven't we ever caught a Bigfoot? Well, why haven't we ever, you know, out here the real world ever caught an alien or a craft? You know, I know that our government does have these things, and we know at the Dulce base, there's a lot of information that we still need to bring forth to the American public. They are here. They are with us. They're in a different realm. You know, they're interdimensional. We have many different types of species that we're working with. There's so many different things, like the Skinwalker and Bigfoot and some of these anomalous creatures that people have seen, you know, the Mothman type and the cryptids. And you said you had somebody that's coming on today after this, you know, that is cryptid. You know, these are all very interesting things. And what's interesting about them is people all over the world have seen the exact same things. And yet for eons, literally, nobody was talking to each other. They were just reporting what was seen.
Yeah.
And it's been, you know, etched in walls and stone and tablets and been written about and all of this. And I truthfully believe that there's been a whole different culture even before man was created on the planet. There's a completely different culture that was covered under the sands of times. And archaeologists today are digging them up and finding out, what is this?
Yeah.
You know, giants, the Nephilim are here. They're finding all of that. The, you know, the skulls and Paracas, you know, skulls that are elongated. All of these things are all coming to fruition, and people are figuring them out at this point, what we're dealing with. And so what's so beautiful about the IUFOB is that, you know, we're now getting answers, and we want to bring these answers to the public. We want to talk about all this. Yeah. Jonathan Redbird Dover, he's amazing. And, you know, you can see right there that we're known as the Paranormal Rangers. They choose this name because the Navajo Rangers were already an established entity under the Navajo Nation. That is amazing. And John is well-spoken, knowledgeable. He is just a wonderful person, really has a lot of information to share.
And you know, one of the things we've talked about on the show pretty regularly is the idea of the Kleenex box. And the idea that, you know, paranormal is a Kleenex box. It's everything. It's anything outside of the normal, anything that you consider quote normal, whatever you bounding you put on that box in your brain, paranormal is anything outside of it. So it doesn't matter if it's a UFO or anything like that. And, you know, the sad thing is though, Terry, is that is what has led to decades and decades of scientists not wanting to be involved, because science wants categorization. That's what they're all about. You know, okay, we have some data. Let's categorize it. Well, if we can't categorize it, we have a problem, you know? And now, and a lot of what I talk about whenever I go out to conferences now is the idea that these things are rapidly converging. The world of science and the world of what we would consider paranormal are rapidly converging, and we are rapidly realizing that there are numerous dimensions, that there's numerous things from the paranormal that are really just kind of parascientific, not necessarily paranormal. Like we're pretty close to them, You know, we have acoustic levitation. We have these things, like, they exist. We have ion driven drones that have no moving parts. You know, it's pretty phenomenal, and it's pretty amazing to see where science is and bringing the world of this kind of research together with science is what's so important. And that's what I love about IFOUB is that they are considering these other things as well.
Right. Because they are interconnected. Yeah. They are a part of the same conversation. And, you know, for years it's been, you know, like I couldn't talk about when I shared my experiences, and I've had so many of them. I've recorded about 150 of them on terryling.com. And that it was like a learning process over the years of all these different things that can and sometimes do happen to people. And I believe I was led through a lot of those so that I could be a voice and I could reach out and relate to others who are absolutely traumatized as I was through so many of these things that they've experienced. So contactees and abductees and people who really have had all manner of different involvement with the paranormal and demonic things, you know,
sure.
Things that are just anomalous. You know, they literally, it's just such a big picture. And, you know, I talked about it for years, and now finally with IUFOB, it's all coming to fruition. It's coming to the table now like it never has before. And of course, AI is a big part of that. We're starting to connect the dots, you know, and so much is now going on that never has been before. We literally are redefining research like never before.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're also a charitable organization. You know, we're dedicated to what we're doing. Everybody is involved that is a part of our board. We are all actively pursuing facts and truth, technology, the AI issues, advancing UFO and UAP research through innovative collaboration and public engagement, because our work relies on the generosity of donors and the dedication of volunteers who share our passion for uncovering the truth and building a deeper understanding of these of all these different types of phenomenon. Yeah, we've got Lexi up and running. She's our AI contributor, and she's amazing, and we love this. She's been, you know, set for just this type of project.
Exactly.
With an extensive background in natural language processing, along with data analysis and trend identification. So, you know, we're working on all these different levels, and I am so proud of what Mindy has brought to the, you know, she's the CEO of IUFOB. I'm the executive director, and we have people on our board who are amazing with top secret clearances. Yep. We have information that will be coming out shortly that'll just be epic in nature. Can't say anything right now, but please log on to the internationalufobureau.com and you'll be kept up with all the latest information and what's happening with us and for us, and just really exciting stuff.
It's absolutely exciting. It has been great to see the path of rapid development.
Yes.
Because it was not but a few months ago, end of summer, that I was in Oklahoma with Mindy scanning files and capturing things and stuff like that. So the fact that in that amount of time, IFOUB has been registered as a 501c3, a board of directors has been found, a path forward, a good forged path forward has been found. And connections are already being made on the back end for collaboration for research and things like that. You know, even, some of the people that Mindy was mentioning that, you know, should we share data with them? It's like, that's what we're about. That's what we're about is the sharing of data, you know? And that's just it. So many other, and you know, I'm a fan of all of them. As Curious Realm and Curious Research, I stand in the middle of the bridge between everybody, you know, and my job is there to signal people, say hi, you know, try and build bridges between people. And it's funny to me how guarded so much research is. You know, and I understand it, you know, like I had friends in college who were vying to go to Chapel Hill in molecular biology, things like that, like to the point, Terry, where like the experiments were sabotaged.
Right.
Things like that. Like that was just college. That was just college to get the funding to go somewhere like somebody willing to jack with somebody's experiment. You know,
right.
So that's the level upon which, unfortunately, a lot of research happens where people are reticent to share because when you share, somebody else ends up taking the research, ends up doing something else with it, and it becomes a guarded thing at that point, you know, and it's one of those like it shouldn't be that way. It should be, once again, what the internet was built for: open communication between researchers. That's like it was that, and then the military use. Those were the first two reasons. So the idea of reopening that gate of the internet the way it's supposed to be, the idea of digitally sharing data with things like other UFO archives, stuff like that.
Right. We're open to, and we've already contacted and are sharing with a lot of others. So that'll all be up and coming on our website. And we're so excited about the website. And I want to just thank you for all your help and your suggestions. I mean, it's just been amazing, putting this all together and learning about all these different complex issues that you deal with all of this. It's been great, you know, but this redefining research and everything, I mean, it has just been wonderful. I love the strategic data analysis and trend identification that we're working with. This is so cool. And I think people are going to be surprised at how wonderful all this has become. And it's something we want to share with everybody because so much information is forthcoming. And even our connection with Washington, D.C. and all the different things that are up and coming. So we're really excited about it. And I don't know, you know, the first responders and all of this that we're doing, you know, with everybody, I just want to say this initiative is fostering such a wonderful relationship with the first responders all over, you know, not just America, but everywhere. And this partnership is only going to empower the responders with tools and knowledge. And it'll also enrich IUFOB's database with critical firsthand accounts and all of their observations. So together, these efforts will enhance public safety by equipping first responders to lead their communities with assurance properly during anomalous events. And, you know, they do have anomalous events all the time.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, in the past, they really haven't had any focus on how to move forward properly, and they will now because we've created it. Mindy and I work so well together at creating criteria needed, and, you know, we did university studies and different things like this, and we're able to put all of this information together and then get it out there. You know, it doesn't do any good to have it and just hold on to it and
keep
it just in one place where you have to buy in. You know, it's better to give than receive. So we're getting it out there and we're making it available to people because a lot of these first responders don't know what they're looking at, don't know what to expect. Well, I mean, look at what happened with the, you know, with everything that went on with the drones. Okay.
Yes.
And look at the conversation that happened around that. I took one look at it and went, they're drones, you know.
And you know, it went deep and it went thick and it went fast. Terry, it went fast. And the first thing that I said was, you know, let's see, we just had a big old hearing that was publicly televised about UFOs, UAPs. And the one question that was asked about 3-4 times was, you know, why isn't this a bigger conversation? And every single one of those people, from Admiral down to former NASA scientists, every one of them said, because if we have it as a larger conversation, then we're revealing a weakness over sensitive areas, a weakness in detection and a weakness in mitigation. Right. And suddenly we start seeing drones all around everywhere. Sensitive areas. And I was like, on air, I was like, next thing you're going to see is a funding hearing. You're going to see an emergency hearing about what's going. And I was interviewing Anthony Esemplaya from Epic TV, who was posting a lot of the drone videos. And we did a pre-record just like we're doing right now.
Right.
And within 3 days of that pre-record being done, there was a hearing happening. And I was like, dude, we've got to do an addendum to that. And it's pretty rare that I've ever done an addendum. I didn't not air the first part. Instead, I put like originally recorded on this date. And then we did another hour of updates about everything that we talked about in the first part that actively came true. Like as we were recording the update, the hearing was happening, you know, and it's like that's the only way that you release funding. It's the only way that funding gets released, you know, and you find out at that point during the hearing that the FBI has a $500,000 budget nationally for drone detection and mitigation technology. And it's like, what?
There's incoming information. You know, but it was really crazy, wasn't it? And people were panicking. And I was surprised, actually, at how many people in the UFO community were stunned, you know, literally stunned at what they were seeing, really believing that those were spiritual orbs or those were UFOs acting wildly, you know, and I'm like, hello, you know,
I don't bust this out frequently, Terry, but that's for you. The applause is for you. Because that's what I said was like, I respect a lot of these people. I consider them to be researchers.
Exactly.
And they are not waiting for data to come out. They are chasing a headline. They're chasing a headline. And when you chase a headline, it's like chasing the wind. It's no different than chasing a conspiracy theory. As soon as the actual facts come out 3 days later, the conspiracy theory now turns left. You know, and there's still another theory out there, you know, and it's the same thing with the DC crash that happened and all kinds of stuff, you know, and it's one of those like it's a sensational way to cover things. We just got done talking about this with Mike Turber literally last week. The idea that we have to wait. It is incumbent upon us, me as a host, anybody that calls themselves, quote, researcher.
Yeah, that's right.
Other than that, you can call yourself author if you want to, because, hey, you're allowed to make anything up you want whenever you write. That's called called fiction. OK, but if you're going to say you're a researcher, that means you are looking for facts. You have maybe an opinion form, but the facts at hand change your opinion, inform your opinion. And you normally say, like, it's my informed opinion that this is what this is. You know,
and you know, I also see the word out there, expert, and I'm like, oh, really? Oh, really? You're an expert. Okay, great. You know, between your right and left ear, because none of us really understand the big picture, you know, independently. Sure. It takes a team together.
That's right.
Because we need to have that conversation with each other. We need to understand what we're talking about, what we're looking at. Where did this come from? How is this happening? It's not just, oh, you know, I'm an expert because I've seen something before. Well, So have everybody else, you know, and they are saying we're researchers. Well, what are you really researching? This is why I'm so proud of Mindy. She and I put together the training processes for a previous program that we did, and we have updated that, and we have really nailed it. This is so much is. I'm so excited about what's going to be forthcoming here at IFOB because we have really taken all of this technology and revamped it, tweaked it, and made it right. So we will be training and teaching and showing people so that they won't be out there.
That's right.
And seeing, you know, that and we had a lot of applauses, you know, from all the different people that were a part of that last training program. But we're so proud of what we're doing now and how it's being conducted. Yeah. So all I can say is, you know, stay with us, folks, because it's going to get better and better and better.
Well, it is exciting. It is exciting to see all these things and to see once again the wheels moving in a different way. Because I think that there has been numerous organizations that have come out over the last 50 years in numerous disciplines of study within the UFO UAP field. But once again, the effort to bring all of that together, the effort to bring all of the ends of research together, the effort to build bridges across the aisle has been a little lacking in some of the ways, and it's been pretty competitive in a lot of the ways. So the idea of opening a channel, the idea of being able to make shareable archives, stuff like that, archives that can be married together and train AI in a greater way. I think especially the AI component, being able to add things, because I think a lot of people fear AI, but that's because AI is basically like, you know, a room of 85 of your friends who are searching Google, you know, and it depends on how they search Google for the answer, you know, so there may be right things, there may be wrong things, but whenever you're using a dedicated research AI, like I use one for my show called SciSummary, that's great, where I can take 8 or 9 scholarly articles or research papers about something like, you know, quantum teleportation, and I can throw those 20 research papers in there and have it coalesce it into a 1,000-word description with 10 bullet points, you know?
Yes.
And it only draws from those 10 studies that I gave it. It doesn't draw from the rest of the internet. It only draws from the HTML page that I give it, you know, things like that. So it's pretty fascinating that those things are out there to help you cull data together, bring data together and analyze it in a different way, you know, because you can begin to train AIs now in specific disciplines and in specific thought forms and how to look for similarities. That's the one thing that I've always said is that with huge archives that have happened, like MUFON, stuff like that, like I would love to see what AI could call together, you know, because it's going to look at the data sets in a different way than we are. And it's going to look at it like the example that I give is 2 years ago when I was at CES, it was announced that the Microsoft AI that they had for laboratory work in 10 hours had found, I think it was like 3,000 or 4,000 replacements for lithium that were all organic compounds, not like a rare earth mineral that we had to mine out of the ground through strip mining or slave labor. You know, these were organic chemicals that you could make in the lab, things like that, and synthesize. And it did that. It was literally decades of lab work that it did in hours.
Yes.
And found all of those replacements. So if you gave it 50 years of citing reports, imagine the data that it could pull out of that. You know, imagine the similarities.
That's exactly what we've been doing.
It's great. And that's just it. That's why I'm glad to see IFOUB actively leveraging this technology, because that's one of the things that many of the the agencies out there looking at things have been reticent to do, to bring AI to the game.
Remember in the 70s, there was an old saying, stupid in, stupid out. Remember that?
Yeah.
And so AI is dependent on who is in charge, who is the one at the computer, who's putting in the questions for you to get the answers. And that is the difference, I think, that IUFOB is making. The people that we're working with are highly intelligent people who really understand what they're doing and have been doing this for literally decades. I've been involved in it, 70 years I've had experiences in this field. And so when you're entering information, AI is able to take that information. Now, and also I need to say this, it has got to be true. If you're putting fiction in, you're going to get fiction back.
That's right.
You put in truth and AI acts very differently.
Yeah.
So these personal experiences and all the different people that we have, surrounded with us in our teamwork approach, the information that we're getting is just unbelievable. It's so encouraging and just exciting, literally the public and government understanding is increasing at this point.
Yeah.
And literally this is just technological innovations because of AI and how it's being put in and what is coming back out to us. So yes, using AI is wonderful. It's a great tool, but it depends on who's inputting.
Yeah, well, it depends.
Literally.
It's like old school computer programming. It depends on how you query the system. It all depends on how you query the system. If you know how to query the system in a different way, you're going to get a different search result.
That's right.
So it's
asking the right questions.
Yeah. Yeah, and in the right way, once again, to bring it back to, sure, maybe there have been some questions asked of tribal communities before, but asking them in the culturally proper way,
that's right,
may yield you a totally different result, And to bring this back to some of those special programs, the one thing that I do love is that first responders program, one of the things we preach about regularly, and I will say preach because I consider myself to be a pastor on it when it comes to the idea of science and the paranormal both begin with the same thing, experience.
Yes.
They both begin with experience. You cannot have any part of the scientific process without experience and observation.
You have to start from that point of understanding and being a part of it.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you're just on the outside looking in. And, this is the problem today. People want their 15 minutes of fame. So they live off of somebody else's, experience, which is so wrong because they haven't experienced it within themselves. They don't really grasp the changes that are made mentally, physically, spiritually, and emotionally. So they're putting in something that's already damaged. And you're right. That's the beginning. Put that clap thing on for yourself right there.
Well, it's quite literally. And when you start breaking that open, it's the fact of, anytime a cop pulls a gun.
Yeah.
They typically go see the psychiatrist a few times afterward. Like that's like your gun comes unholstered. You will go see somebody to talk about it.
Yes.
Now, the question is, when you are asked to respond to a situation a life-changing paranormal event happens to you.
Right.
Are you just put back out on the street the next day? Because that's a point of change. That's a point of catharsis in somebody's life. No different than the shock and awe that it does to your system of having to pull your gun and that quandary that goes on of I may have to end somebody right now. There's no different the response in the brain and emotionally. So the fact that first responders are given a chance to anonymously give their report that they may not even be able to give to their chief of deputies, to their fire chief or something like that without fear of reprisal or losing their career.
Exactly. And, you know, like an abductee or a contactee, a first responder will build on their experiences and their knowledge base and how they responded literally, personally, to and mentally to what they had to see.
Yeah.
I'm so grateful for first responders. Oh my goodness. You know, they have so much to overcome, but they have such a plethora of information to share with us and, you know, help us to understand how we actually move forward once these traumatic experiences have come to us, because contactees are in that same place as a first responder. It's the first time these kinds of things are happening to us.
Yep.
And we have to wrap our minds around otherworldly, previously unknown situations that we now have to deal with. And, you know, one of the first things I said to the Lord when I was going through my first experience in 1969 with UFOs is I said, Lord, where do I put this? Where do I put this? Yeah. And I literally said that out loud because I was so mind boggled. You know, I couldn't relate to what I had just experienced with my own two green eyes.
Yeah.
I'm like, I don't get it.
My first real life changing experience happened when I was about 15, 16 years old, while I was serving at the altar. I've told the story on the show before, but it was an experience of full on bilocation.
Right.
I was in that church and I was somewhere else at the same time. And I'm getting goosebumps right now thinking about it.
Yeah.
And it was one of the, I was fortunately not silent. I fortunately had a priest, Father John Upton, who we had talked about numerous paranormal things, UFOs, things like that. So I went to him literally directly after Mass and was like, do you have a minute? Like, I know I'm going to be late to Sunday school, but I've got to tell you what just happened to me. And he was the one who was like, that's beautiful. I wish something like that would happen to me. In my faith, he's like, you should explore that. Have you ever considered entering the seminary? And as an altar server for a good 10 years of my life at that point, almost there had been numerous priests who'd mentioned it. You know, it's kind of like being in ROTC in junior high and high school and nobody asking you if you want to join the Marines.
Right.
You know,
yes,
but it was the first time that I ever considered it. And it was the first time that I'd ever considered that life changing path of saying yes and following it, you know, but it had there not been somebody like Father John, because I'm sure my mother's heard the story on the show. I don't know that I've ever directly told her. I've told my brother, you know, but there were very few people that I had ever told this experience to. So the fact that I trusted Father John enough to share that with him is pretty amazing.
Right.
But most people do not have that trusted person. They don't have somebody that they can go to. I mean, it breaks up families. It breaks up marriages. It breaks up relationships. You know, one of the big ones that you can talk about is Pascagoula.
My goodness. Yes.
Even Travis Walton and his friend Mike Rogers, you know, they are no longer friends because of the experience.
I know all kinds
of things. So it's fascinating the way that it divisively pulls people apart, you know.
Yes, because it is so otherworldly and so hard to relate to. And like you said, you didn't even really tell your mother about it. And I have found that to be true. I actually did tell my mother, and she told me, don't you dare tell anybody else because they will think you are crazy. And when I was with MUFON, I was not allowed to tell the truth. I was forbid, Do not mention God. Do not mention the paranormal. Do not mention these things. And if you do, I was threatened. I was literally threatened, which is why I resigned. You know, sure. I'm no longer there. I won't live in a lie. I won't live in a situation where I can't be honest and bring forth what really happened, even though it was life-changing. It was the most profound thing that happened to me other than becoming a Christian.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it separated me from everybody. I had nowhere to go. Mm. And even there, I wasn't accepted. I was never accepted. You know, the truth, once you tell the truth, you are going to make more enemies than you could ever imagine, you know, because people can't handle the truth, if I could quote Cruz, okay?
That's true.
Yeah. Well, they can't handle the truth. Or who was it? The other guy said it, or who said it?
Yeah, it was Jack Nicholson.
Jack Nicholson, yeah, with Tom Cruise. Yeah, you can't handle the truth. But, you know, a lot of people truly can't.
Well,
it causes such deep divisions and divides in families. It does.
It does. In families and in communities, Terry, you know.
Yes.
And it's one of those that, once again, science at one point was not willing to talk about these things because of this stuff. And I think now they are finally starting to realize, like, oh, no, no. We need to explore it. We have to look at it, you know.
Right. It's a part of their conversation at this point. They can't move further without bringing this into their conversation. And I'm so over the moon about that.
Well, it's because
I've been saying that for 50 years.
it's because books like this exist. This is an actual scientific desk reference of strange phenomena. At one point, things like this existed. This was printed the last time, the year of my birth, 1975, was when this came out. This was the last edition. But it's a desk reference full of all kinds of phenomena, like ball lightning, articles going back to the 1700s, stuff like that. Because it's a part of science that you've got to be able to eliminate that from the data set. You've got to be able to see, like, okay, well, what is that? You know, so the only way to get to the unknown and to narrow down the 3-5% of unknown is to go through what we know. And we've got to be able to look at the strange phenomena. And I mean, that's honestly one of the big reasons why I am a fan of the relabel from UFO to UAP.
Yes.
Because UFO keeps it in that, once again, that Kleenex box of paranormal. Right. When you change it to anomalous phenomena, that's quite literally in the wheelhouse of science, because you have to eliminate the anomaly within an experiment so that you have proper data. You know, if I made a solution of things and 5% of that solution disappeared as it changed into a solid, well, did that off gas? What happened to the 5%?
Yeah.
That's now the job of science. I wouldn't get an A in chemistry if I couldn't figure out what happened to the 5%. Show me the 5% remainder. Did it become sediment? Did it off gas? Did it become liquid? What happened to the remaining 5% of solution? That's the anomaly in that scientific part.
Right. And this segues right into feeding AI the right information.
That's right.
You know, so that you can get the right response. You know, this is just, you know, such a great time to be alive and such a great time to be living with this understanding and this knowledge and all that we have in front of us. I am so grateful for Lexi, you know, for what we're doing here at the International UFO Bureau. I would invite everybody to go to iufob.com and become a part of the subscriptions that we have. You can sign up. Doesn't cost you anything. You can be a part of the subscription, and we will keep you posted on where we're going and what we're doing and how it's happening and what we learn, what we know. We're very open. We're extremely transparent. We want you to know and be a part of the conversation along with us. We're looking to partner with others, literally work with us.
Yeah.
And, you know, people can read that if they're ready, if they literally are ready to, you know, stop all this, you know, we're the experts over here. We're the only ones who have this understanding. You know, we need to be part of the team. We all need to be in agreement with each other. We need to understand this. And this is what we're bringing forward now. And in just such a way that has never been done before, you know, we don't disassociate with you because you use certain terminologies or verbiage, you know. We're here to learn as much as we can. We're all, our days are numbered, so we want to know as much as we can know about what's going on. And plenty is going on.
Tons.
Look at what is happening in our world today. We have earthquakes. We have all kinds of things happening. We have storms. We have polar plunges. We have summer in the middle of February, you know?
Yeah.
And then we'll have a polar plunge in the middle of February. Things are happening in such a strange way all over the planet. And we need to be awake and aware. You know, we need to be paying attention to what's happening. And, you know, I hope that people will come along with us and learn with us. It's so exciting.
Well, really. Hope is the great word here, you know, because there is hope. There's great hope for the future of ufology right now. And in the field of UFO UAP study, and I know a lot of people are frustrated with hearings, things like that. Yeah. But make no mistake, folks, without the hearings, like that's how you end up with the hearing like Iran-Contra, where you have Anali North up there taking an oath and saying it was me. You know, even if we end up with a fall guy out of all of it from an alphabet agency or from a contractor thereof standing in front of Congress, we will at least have some answers then. But the only way that we get that is through illegal means. You know, the only way that we get that is through it's nobody's going to roll a cart with wreckage out onto the floor of Congress with an aha Houdini moment, pulling a sheet. Aha, there it is. Like that's not what's going to happen. There's not going to be a big tube with an alien in it. You know, like that's not what's going to happen on the floor of Congress. But you will see meetings. You will see funding released. You will see funding for research released. You will see things like, you know, alphabet agencies being called to the table eventually, or contractors thereof once again, you know, to answer these whistleblower questions and other things that are coming through SCIFs. So the fact that International UFO Bureau has started during the midst of all this, I think is really fantastic, because there are a lot of entrenched names. There are a lot of entrenched research groups out there. And that's fantastic. And they're doing good work. All of them are doing good work. I will not say any of them are doing bad work, you know.
They're just doing work. Yeah.
But we've to see this new effort, to see this effort to include future-looking technologies in the way that we look at data, and to start bringing in indigenous cultures into the fold, like into the actual research, not just gathering some witness statements from them and things like that, but actively having them weigh in on it. Like that's hugely important. So congratulations. It's fantastic to see the things that you guys have done, starting IUFOB. InternationalUFOBureau.com, everybody, is where you can go for the website. That is where you can go to like, follow, subscribe, everything else. Terry, before we let you go, let everybody know where they can go to find your work. Because, of course, IFOUB is still getting up and running. You will be able to put encounters in and witness statements very soon, folks. So whenever that happens, I guarantee you we will have them back on to announce it and talk about it. But let everybody know where they can go to find your work, where they can go to follow your show, all kinds of good stuff, Terry.
Well, we have, Kevin and I have taken down my book about the alien healing, a benevolent experience with a UFO and a extraterrestrial. But we will be putting that back probably in March, which will be, you know, on Amazon again. And it's an experience that I had, and many people are interested in that because it was very telling. It really brought forth a lot of information that previously hadn't been understood. And I had to pull it back because so much has come forth with that understanding, the new knowledge
yeah.
about how that all happened. So we're redoing it and adding all of the back information now. So it'll actually be more in book form. I made almost like a mini book out of it, you know, originally, because I just wanted, my heart was to just get the information out to the people that this is possible. So yeah. people would understand if they had something like this happen to them. I'm always one to share immediately as much as I can. And sometimes I do it very, you know, very quickly. But again, going to terryling.com is where I have a lot of my older information available for people. The different things I've done in ufology with demons as a demonologist and a paranormal investigator and a field investigator and enigmatic anomalies, you know, a show host there and all the different things that I experienced in my life, personal things that have happened. I was the host of EA News Update, EA Radio, and EA TV as well. And so all of that is there. Some of the different things that I've done can be seen there. And we're still building that too. I'm not as focused on myself as I want to be focused on IUFOB and a lot of information about what I'm doing and where I've been in my lifetime and this, you know, journey I'm on will be incorporated into that. A lot of teaching, a lot of training, a lot of the different things that we've been looking into over the past 4 years, Mindy and I. So thank you so much for having me
Always.
On. Very, very grateful to have been here. I love being a part of what you're doing, and I can't say
Thank
enough
you.
About you.
Thank literally. You so much, Terry.
You're such a blessing.
It has been a fantastic friendship since the time that we've met, and you know, I am very, very excited once again to see what you guys are doing with the International UFO Bureau, and I'm so proud to be a part in the way that I am. So.
Thank
you so much for everything always. Please do hold the line real quick while we flip out from this segment. While you are online checking out everything from Terry Linkell as well as the International UFO Bureau, everybody, make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. Curious Realm is where you can like, follow, subscribe. That's where you can find all of our episodes. That's where you can find the store. If you like what you hear from our guests, you can always find their books right here on the Curious Realm store, curiousrealm.com/store. It's where you can buy your copy of the Field Observation and Encounter Log, everybody. If you're a UFO investigator, cryptid investigator, or investigator of the paranormal, this is your field log to write down your data in the field as it happens, so it is ready to shake hands with science. Come that day. When we come back from this commercial break, we will be joined by our good friend Ryan Edwards. We will be talking about Gugwe research and how Gugwe, the Mi'kmaq cryptid, is possibly related to Bigfoot and Dogman and other things here in North America. We will get into that right after this quick commercial break.
The key to good science is good research. At the heart of good research is a good data set. With the Field Observation and Encounter Log from Curious Research, you can easily keep track of your investigative information all in one place, making it easier to review cases and readily see comparisons and contrasts between them. Whether out in the woods squatching, in a back room gathering EVPs, or using high-tech gear to track UFO-UAP activity, this easy-to-carry, pocket-sized scientific data log is the perfect companion for any field researcher. You can find your copy of the Curious Research Field Observation and Encounter Log at Amazon.com or visit the official Curious Realm store at curiousrealm.com/store to reserve your copy for yourself, your family, or a mind that you want to open. That website again is curiousrealm.com/store.
Well, hello, everybody, and thank you for hanging on through that quick commercial break. Also, thank you so much to our sponsors, especially True Hemp Science. True Hemp Science is my source for amazing CBD products. I was recommended years ago by my doctor CBD for my travel anxiety and just daily use. It has been amazing in my life. It's been great. I can attest to the products at True Hemp Science. Christopher Lynch uses this phygeric process, using, reusing, and then combusting and reusing every part of the plant, from roots to seeds to stems to leaves to buds. Every part of the hemp plant is used to create an amazing CBD product with terpene profiles and everything, folks. Stop on by and check them out. TrueHempScience.com is the website that you want to use. Curious7 is the code that you want to use to save 7% off your entire cart of $50 or more and get two edibles on your way out the door. Our guest in this segment is our good friend Ryan Edwards. Ryan Edwards is a cryptozoologist out of the San Antonio area. He has written a couple of books, one of them on cryptids from around the world, and then one of them on a modern look at the Bigfoot phenomena. We are having him on today to talk about the Gugwe, which is a cryptid from the northeast of America. Welcome back to the show, Ryan Edwards. How you doing, buddy?
Doing good, buddy. Always good to be here.
Absolutely, man. We just had Symposium of the Strange a few days ago. It was fantastic. We had a great showing. It was great. You actually filled in for Josh Turner, who took ill and was not able to make it. But we still talked about Dogman and other phenomena like that. And one of the first things that you talked about was the Gugwe. And it's traditional heritage, things like that. And it's always fascinated me. I lived in Maine for many years of my life, that is where I first heard about the Gugwe, with the Mi'kmaq tribe being directly above us in Nova Scotia. Let's get a little bit into the Gugwe and what it's all about, Ryan.
Of course. Well, the name Gugwe itself originates from the Mi'kmaq tribe. It originally was pronounced either Gugwe or Gaugau, and it literally means face eater. These are described as separate from the Sasquatch in the area. They're seen as more violent, more territorial, and also morphologically different from Sasquatch. They're seen as having more of a mandrill or baboon-like face with an actual protruding muzzle, very similar to like what we see in modern-day Papuans, like okay. Baboons and geladas. They're also described as much more violent. They're described as having long claws and large teeth. And these teeth are very much like large canines and large, almost dog-like dentition. But with it, it's very similar to a Sasquatch in body size. But the head is what's really different from it. And also, the digits are different from Sasquatch. Supposedly, these Gugwe have three toes and not five toes like a modern-day usual Sasquatch. If you want to see a good representation of Gugwe, look up the Beast of Seven Shoots. You have it on your screen right now. This photo was taken back in the early 2000s. Man was taking a photo in the Park the Seven Shoots up in Canada. And he was taking a photo of a waterfall. And in the bottom right-hand corner of this photo shows a creature. If you look at it, it looks like almost like a Bigfoot, but with a baboon-like head. And supposedly, it's carrying a small white dog in its arms. So that could be a good representation of Gugwe. And when we take a replica photo of the same area, it's shown that creature is probably around 7 to 8 feet tall. Much larger than any humans just walking in the woods.
Fascinating, man. And, you know, once again, many of these stories, Sasquatch, the little people in the Appalachian Mountains, things like that, many of these stories begin in native cultures. What do the Mi'kmaq up there say about Gugwe? How did this story begin, or I guess how did the stories of Gugwei begin? I'm not going to say that Gugwei doesn't exist. How did these accounts begin in the native culture?
Well, with the natives, they would reference, of course, Sasquatch living in the area. But then they would say at certain times of year, especially during the fall and the winter, these Sasquatch creatures would leave. They would go into another territory. They believe they went south. And when these Sasquatch creatures left, another creature came in. These were the Gugwei. These were these face eaters that were much more violent than these Sasquatch. Supposedly, they would raid indigenous camps. They would actually predate on humans. They would see humans as prey.
Interesting.
They would move in. They'd move in groups. They'd move in like almost like hunting parties. Supposedly, some Mi'kmaq tribes say state that the Gugwei would actually dig pit traps, very similar like how we do with modern day boar. So humans would fall in these pit traps, and they would get caught by these Gugwei. And supposedly, the Gugwei is primarily in the northeast, but in recent years, these Gugwei sightings have been spreading throughout the country. One area where there are a lot more modern-day Gugwei sightings is the Mississippi River Valley. Places like Missouri, places like even parts of even western Arkansas, again, sightings of these Bigfoot but with baboon-like faces. And this is the interesting part with the Gugwei. Is it a Sasquatch? Also, we have the dogman phenomenon occurring as well, with these dog-like creatures with a wolf-like head. Gugwei is described kind of like a mix of a little bit of both. I don't think it's some type of hybridization between dogman and Bigfoot, which some people believe.
Sure.
Doesn't make any sense genetically, but then you have the idea of like these ideas mixing of like, is it a Bigfoot? Is it a Gugwei? Is it a dogman? That's why there's a lot of nuance to this research. Like, for instance, the Gugwei has only really come out into modern research into the past couple of years. If you look at any Bigfoot book or cryptozoological book from, like, let's just say starting in 2016 backwards, you're not going to really see references to the Gugwei. And if you do, you're going to reference it as just another name for Bigfoot. But when you really look at the morphology and the stories of these creatures, it's something very much different from what we see as Sasquatch. That's why I put in my book, Beyond Bigfoot, the Unknown Unrecognized Primates of North America, I put as a separate species.
Yeah.
And interesting-wise, with origin possibly, I put it more akin to the devil monkey phenomena. Because devil monkeys are described as very similar to Gugwei's, but more baboon-like than Bigfoot-like.
Well, and, you know, it's interesting that you bring up, the connection, impossible connection. Even the wiki that I had up a minute ago was mentioning the possible connection to Dogman and Bigfoot. And as you were saying, you know, many people think it may be a crossbreed between the two, something like that. One of the things we discussed and that we've discussed on the show previously, that we discussed Wednesday night during the Q&A, is the idea of the cultural stories and where they come from. And even the idea of Dogman, whenever you look at many of the places around the country where Dogman is seen, where Dogman is sighted, not only are you looking at Native American populations, but you're also looking at Germanic populations and French descendant populations, where both of those have a rich tradition of werewolf and lycanthropy stories, you know, whether you're talking Beast of Jeverdon, what have you. So the idea of, and where I'm going with this is especially the idea of cross-pollination of these cultural stories, as not only tribes met each other as they moved, hunted, gathered, things like that, but also as they intermarried. And as Anglo culture and French culture and everything else intermarried with them.
Yes. Like, that's the one thing that I always bring up with any type of modern day cryptid sightings. Is one aspect of cryptozoology I look at very much intensely is the indigenous stories. Mm. And how much are the indigenous stories kind of bastardized by mixing with the cultural, the colonizing culture? Like, for instance, I brought it up during the symposium, the Wendigo. The Wendigo from Algonquin stories is very much different from what we see as the Wendigo nowadays. People see the Wendigo now as like some type of bipedal deer-like creature. That never existed within Algonquin stories. That originated thanks to modern-day ideas of like lycanthropy and werewolfism and things like that. And even with recent research into a book I'm working on right now, a lot of indigenous stories of African stories. Like, for instance, right now I'm working on a book of African cryptids, and a lot of the cryptids of, let's just say, the Congo have been really changed and bastardized thanks to European ideologies. I will bring up ideas of like the Mokema Bembe and the Mila Natoka.
Sure.
When you bring up these cryptids, people assume they're living dinosaurs, thanks to researchers like Roy Mackle and Gibbons. They believe that these are living dinosaurs. But when you look at the original indigenous stories, Mokema Bembe means two meanings. It's either the flow of the one that stops the flow of rivers, or it literally means rainbow. And the original story is actually not referencing something with a long neck or anything like that. They're referencing what sounds like maybe more like akin to like a giraffe or a rhinoceros. Rich, people don't realize the Congo, before it was ever a jungle, was actually open savanna, which the indigenous people there lived there around 15,000 years ago. So are these stories of Emile Toka's, Mokema Bembe's actually indigenous cultural memories of rhinos, elephants, and giraffes that are no longer indigenous there? But thanks to the more fantastical side of it, people that have already sometimes have a premeditated idea make these ideas of living dinosaurs.
Yeah.
Because you'll find out with a lot of these living dinosaur sightings, especially in the Congo and the rope bit of Papua New Guinea, it's coming from a religious aspect. These people that think, well, these modern-day dinosaur sightings were because for, like, you see younger creationists and things like that going after them. Mm. Well, think what me and you've brought up. If you come into an investigation with a premeditated notion, you're, of course, going to find evidence for that.
Yeah, yeah.
Kind of anything that's not doesn't support that evidence, you're not going to bring up in your research, which is what I'm finding now is a lot of other things that state that, no. Like, for instance, the Mila Natoka describes a large animal with a long tail and a nose and a hole on its nose. What the indigenous are probably describing is a rhinoceros, not some type of ceratopsian. Mm. So you see these ideas of cultures mixing throughout time, and usually the colonizing culture overlapping the indigenous and kind of overtaking the indigenous, because a lot of oral traditions are not as recorded as the colonizing culture coming into it.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. They're passed on oral traditions, things like that. And which, you know, in most cases, when uninterrupted, is way more accurate than writing it down. It's fascinating whenever you do look at cultures that have unbroken oral tradition. Exactly how, because most of these things, like, Sasquatch, Gugwe, like we're talking about, and Wendigo, stuff like that, they aren't necessarily seen as something that is not. They are seen as something to be warned about. They are seen as something that lives in the woods just adjacent to us. You know, that these things have their own culture. These things have their own life aside from us, you know. So it's something that you live next to and you respect. Kind of like if you live in bear country, you know.
Yeah.
You just kind of treat your trash in a different way because you live in bear country, you know. But if you live in the middle of Detroit, you don't treat your trash the same way you do as someone with bears, you know?
Yeah.
So the question does come to bear, like, at what point do these things separate? Because, you know, as we were talking about, and it's interesting to see how modern culture plays a part in these things, stuff like that. But as you said, a prime example is the Wendigo. You know, whenever you start getting into the traditions of it, everything else, it is much more like a possessive spirit that yes. takes over somebody, kind of like a hunger that takes over someone, than a creature like what you see now. Like, even if you just do a Wendigo image search, you'll see the traditional image there. But every other image is, like you were talking about, a bipedal deer-type creature, which is 180 degrees different from the traditional description.
Yes.
And from what tradition teaches.
Yeah, and even, like, for instance, I did a presentation last year on cultural cryptids, I like to call it. Mm. Look at the modern-day culture and how does it affect cryptozoology? Like, for instance, we're especially modern-day, the ideas of, like, skinwalkers and the Gi-Nahalushi. Everyone, if someone sees a weird video of something weird in the woods, they think it's some type of skinwalker. They don't realize the old traditions of the Gi-Nahalushi originates from the Navajo tribe. Not the skinwalker isn't, just because you're a native land doesn't mean you have skinwalkers. It doesn't work like that. Because of modern day interpretations and the modern day kind of ideas of like skinwalkers, everyone assumes that every Native American tribe has some type of skinwalker. Not every tribe has that.
Yeah.
Or even I kind of talk about like the rake or these what we call pale crawlers that people sure. see nowadays. People legitimately believe the rake exists in the world and out there in nature, but the rake was literally created off of creepypasta. It was created on Reddit, I think, in 2014 and in a fictitious story. But people still see it in the woods. So it even brings up like what we always talk about, like, are people's realities being altered thanks to their belief in something? Or is it something that, like, almost like a Buddhist topa, you put enough thought into it, it will exist into your world?
Sure.
And sure. Like the same thing is happening with these gugwees. Are there more gugwee sightings because people are now recognizing the morphology of a gugwee? Or are people seeing more gugwees now because, oh, I heard about this Bigfoot with a muzzle and I saw some weird looking Bigfoot, it has to be a gugwee. Like, I'll even take, for instance, an example that happened here in Texas. I believe it was called the Aurora Monster. This is a Bigfoot that I've seen out in West Texas back in the 70s.
Hmm.
It was by near El Paso. And when you look up the pictures of this creature, it shows almost like a protruding muzzle with like little canines. But when you talk to the people there's not many living witnesses of this creature because of when it happened. But some of the newspapers stated like, yeah, this creature had like a kind of like a muzzle, kind of like a mandrill. So was this a gugwee? But then again, there's no gugwee sightings, really. It's not that many gugwee sightings east of, like, west of the Mississippi. So if that is some type of gugwee creature, it's very far out of its natural range. But then again, we're looking at it from a modern-day perspective. That's a hard thing when, like, doing cryptozoology research like this. We're putting our own modern-day perspectives on older ideas and even sometimes ancient ideas. So it alters sure. it to an example. Like, for instance, how, like, we brought up the Wendigo. Now there's an idea of the Wendigo psychosis, of that maybe there is some type of psychosis that causes you to think you're a Wendigo and you will have to consume human flesh. Swift Runner, well-known Wendigo, was killed for being a Wendigo, and because he killed and ate people, we think he might have had a psychosis.
Yeah.
But is the modern day ideas the true reason why these stories come about, or is it just us putting our modern day perspectives on an ancient belief? I think, like with werewolves, now we have lycanthropy, we have werewolfism, we have the werewolf psychosis. is this the reason why we have werewolf stories, or are these werewolf stories originating from like the Dogman and sightings like that? It's hard to tell.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and I mean, granted, I would say the prior, the fact that, you know, these stories, especially lycanthropy, goes back to King Lycan. That's ancient Greece, you know, and there are stories of wolf men, men becoming wolves, all kinds of things. And, you know, that can also, as you said, speak to a type of psychosis, speak to a type of way that, somebody becomes after something, you know, and that's just what is described as the beast, so to speak. You know, so there are a couple ways to approach that phenomenology and how to look at that. And even when you're looking at things from a cultural point of view and from the point of view of a native culture, like you were saying earlier with invading cultures coming in, how these things morph together, you know, because it doesn't take long. Like you said, the rake is off of Creepypasta, and it's everywhere now. You'll see episodes about it, people talking about it, people talking about sightings and everything. And that was much like Slenderman. Slenderman was a contest on Creepypasta that took on its own life, and so much so that two girls tried to sacrifice their best friend to Slenderman in the woods. This is how far it went, you know, this, and, you know, when you're talking about psychosis, quote, psychosis, air quotes there, everybody, psychosis, these two girls got to a point of fervent fandom so hard, and the disassociation of not being able to separate fact from fantasy, and the fact that, then the fact that this thing was utter fantasy and utterly made up, but willing to sacrifice that to the point of sacrificing another human to meet Slenderman, you know, and it's you have to be willing to explore that. You have to be willing to explore the phenomenology of that mindset and the way that the brain is willing to do such things. You know, that we are willing sometimes to sacrifice logic, frighteningly enough, to have something make sense in our mind.
Yeah. You know? Like, even think of, it's very simplistic, but even think of like ideas like Santa Claus. How many kids, when they're younger, act good because they think Santa won't bring them presents if they don't? Like, the ideas of like how belief affects our behavioral sets. Like, I like to call it like the psychology of cryptozoology, because a lot of these cryptids, a lot of these, especially I like to call these paracryptids, are much more beings of psychological and psychosis than really beings living out into the physical world. Like, things of like these Wendigo signs, these like, or even modern cryptids like the not deer. How people say, oh yeah, you see a deer, but it's different somehow.
Yeah.
That only came about in the last 5 years. Well, but yeah, I've literally had people come to me with sightings of these things. But I'm like, well, this kind of popped out of nowhere. What are they talking about?
Well, like, and one of the things culturally specifically that you have to remember, especially with the analogy of St. Nicholas, Santa Claus, you know, and being a good little boy or girl, The Santa Claus that we know, red and white Santa that you go meet at the mall and everything else, that is utterly a transition of Coca-Cola. Coca-Cola created that image and that imagery of Santa Claus. That is what's put out there. What was traditionally there was St. Nicholas. And flip coin side of St. Nicholas was Krampus. Krampus is what kept the little kids in line. It wasn't St. Nicholas who saw if you were good or naughty. St. Nicholas was going to bring you something anyway. The question was whether or not Krampus was going to come and take your soul in the middle of the night and throw you in his basket and take you to hell with him and torture you with chains and switches.
And Krampus, kind of like a almost like a revitalization in modern days. Like literally earlier this year in San Antonio, Texas, we literally had a Krampus parade.
It has been a huge rebirth. Rebirth. And once again, you know, especially when you might be like, what are you doing that in San Antonio, Texas? Well, you know, there is a great amount of Polish and Czech population. So that Eastern European influence is all over Texas, especially central Texas. And even whenever you take that to Russia and Western Europe, you're talking about the tradition of Black Peter, which was pretty much the same thing. He was just literally a flip coin of Santa Claus.
Or the Yule Lads, these 13 goblins that would come into town and like mess with the children during Yule time. Like, it's kind of funny. This could be a podcast episode by itself. Like, the ideas of Christmas creatures, or these almost Christmas demons that would come and like harm children if they acted badly. Like, Krampus is only one example from multiple cultures that had the same idea set.
Well, and you know, to bring this back to Gugwe and Bigfoot and Dogman and things like that, whenever you look at the traditional descriptions of Gugwe, face eater, all right, you know, give me a second, folks. However, when you look at those, they are very much guardian spirit. Once again, they live adjunct to humanity, directly over there in the tree. We're living over here in the field. They're living in the trees adjoining the field. And once again, though, there's a society that they belong to that lives adjunctly to us that follows many of the similar rules. However, there are other rules that are there. And most of those rules are warning rules of how to treat and respect the spirit of the woods. Otherwise, bad things will happen. Crops will fail. Yes. Children will disappear. You'll disappear. Don't go following their songs in the woods. Don't follow their invitation to come with them. If they offer you food, don't take it. You know, things like that. So there is much, quote, fair warning there in order to have that association with them and to live adjunctly with them in peace. The question is, at what point are those rules broken? You know? And it's interesting because I see in many groups where people talk about the strata and rules of Sasquatch society, things like that, you know, and it's fascinating to me to even explore the option of it. Because you know, whenever you look at great apes, whenever you look at, other animals, there is definitely a society, a pecking order. There is a means of communication, even amongst dogs. There is a means of communication of the pecking order, you know? So the question is whether or not we understand that and whether or not we understand if we are violating those rules, you know? So what are some of the, I guess, societal rules as far as dealing with Gugwe, things like that?
With Gugwe, it was very similar. It was very much like how they would treat like Sasquatch. Don't go into the woods at night. One big thing was Gugwe was very known for whistling. So the idea is like, don't whistle at night. That's very much most native traditions have that. Is that like evil spirits would whistle at night. Very much if you go into the woods, even if you're a young man, like a warrior, you go in with multiple people because these Gugwes would be able to like hunt you. They would be able to like surround you and use hunting tactics on you. So you go in as a group. They would have larger fires during this time of season to keep these creatures away. But there are all stories of these Gugwes entering like small villages and taking the whole village away. Like, interesting, we've heard of the Nahanni Valley. The Naha people, the supposed Nahas of the Nahanni Valley, a lot of times these Bigfoot in the Nahanni Valley are described as having mandrel-like muzzles very similar to the Gugwe. And of course, what is the Nahanni Valley also known as? The Headless Valley, or the Valley of Headless Men. So maybe this could be a small population of Gugwes that also live in this area as well. but that are also hunting humans like what they do back in the Mi'kmaq regions. But I think the reason why we're seeing them now here in the South a little bit more is because we know climatic changes, population growth of humans. Maybe these creatures are moving into areas where we've never seen them before. Like maybe they're being seen in areas like parts of Texas, parts of even I've gotten a good friend of mine, a man named Ryan Paul Trimbley. Mm-hmm. He said he might have even gotten a guggly sighting out in Arizona.
Oh, wow.
Like we're seeing these sightings go even farther west.
Yeah.
Now, is this a possible migration of these creatures? Or is it just us perceiving the guggly phenomenon more than what we thought of before? And even a mixture could be even like the devil monkey. Like sure. The devil monkey is described as very guggly-like, but just more anthropoid, more baboon-like than the guggly's more humanoid, more hominid-like. So could these creatures maybe be mistaken identities for each other?
Sure.
Because the devil monkey is described as like a giant baboon about the size of like a human with three toes as well, based on the guggy.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, once again, that's where you start getting into, as we've had you on to discuss before, variations and variegations in animals themselves and in a species. You know, yeah. the idea that it's not a different animal, the skunk ape and the Sasquatch. They're the same animal. You know, it's just one of them is adapted to live in the swamp. Another one's been adapted to live in thick forest. You know, that's all. It's a basically a genetic adaptation to a localized environment.
Yeah, and it's not a subspecies. Well, like a lot of people like to say, it's what we call an ecological ecomorph. Due to the ecology, they're morphologically different. Mm. Like, for instance, black bears in the lower 48 are smaller than the black bears in Canada and parts of Alaska.
Yeah.
Black bears along the eastern coast are usually smaller than the ones on the west coast because it's much larger areas, much larger game. So, like, ecomorphs occur a lot of times within even the same species. Heck, think of people. People on islands, people like Filipinos, things like that, people like that are much shorter than people in parts of Europe and parts of other parts of the world. We don't say they're a subspecies. Of course not. We say they are morphologically smaller thanks to a different environment. Ecomorphs are very common within primates, especially higher order primates. So that would make sense for like Bigfoot and other creatures like this to have ecomorphs, just like how gorillas do and chimpanzees do.
Well, and I mean, what do you think? Because, of course, there is the North American Wood Ape Conservancy. There is, of course, the idea that Bigfoot Sasquatch himself is a primate of a lost order that is just a long-bred species. For those of you not familiar with that, kind of the idea that, like, you know, an animal is like 20 years old before it's prepared to breed, you know, and it's not like they're breeding every like twice a year like rabbits or once a year like deer even. You know, once they're of breeding age, they may only breed or pair once in their life, twice in their life, you know, to propagate the species. So much like things like lowland gorillas, that kind of stuff, where even pandas, you know, the idea that like pandas, you know, it's not that they're exceedingly rare. It's just that the numbers are so low because they don't breed regularly, even once they're of breeding age.
Yeah, like in zoos, it's known that like breeding populations of pandas, it's very hard to do because they just don't breed that much.
Yeah.
Like it's not a common occurrence for them.
Yeah. Yeah. So the idea of what do you think the odds are of a primate of that type? Being in the woods of America, especially something along the lines of devil monkey, or even along the lines of Gugwey.
Well, I think, the probability, it's kind of hard to say, because like with Sasquatch, think you already have Sasquatch, we know for sure, probably living in North America. Then you have like signs of like devil monkeys. and then Gugwe. So are there like three or four different types of cryptid primates living in North America alongside each other? It doesn't sound likely, but just my speculation is this. I believe these devil monkeys evolved here in North America. People don't realize, but the primate genus started in North America about 64 million years ago. We had the earliest lemurs lived in North America during the Eocene. So possibility that some of these creatures might have evolved and adapted into what we now know as devil monkeys. But then I think the devil monkey phenomena and the Gugwe phenomena are correlated to each other because of morphological and even behavioral similarities. I think the devil monkey became the Gugwe thanks to them co-evolving alongside Bigfoot. I think this is what we call convergent evolution. Think of dolphins and sharks. Think of dolphins and ichthyosaurs. They all have the same body shape, but they are very different creatures. Hyenas and wolves, very different people. They're very different creatures, but they look the same. I think Gugwe and Sasquatch convergently evolved to become very similar, but have very different niches. A Bigfoot is a large omnivore. It's very much like very similar to like a bear. These Gugwes are seen as more like the think of like a Bigfoot being like a black bear, more omnivorous, even maybe more plants than meat.
Sure.
The Gugwe, I think, is more the polar bear of the Sasquatch world. It's very much mostly meat. If you look at the muzzle on these creatures, that implies a much more carnivorous diet. Even the devil monkey is seen as more carnivorous than Sasquatch. So that means they would be in different niches. They wouldn't be competing with each other. That's maybe why the Mi'kmaq referenced that when the winter and like fall came, the Sasquatch would leave and the Gugwe would come in. They would be what we call a niche differentiation or niche specialization. They have very similar niches, but they avoid each other. Something even happened within our own natural history. Neanderthals and cave hyenas. They both like the same caves. They hunted the same prey. But what they would do is one season, the cave hyena would have the cave. Next season, Neanderthals would be found in it. Maybe the same thing kind of occurs with Gugwes and Sasquatch. But of course, the Gugwe would have a much smaller population. Most signs of Gugwe occur with like single ones. It's only a one creature. I think these would be like the major predators that they would be a lone hunter, unless they were to come into smaller groups to hunt larger prey or even hunt humans. But very much they would be not like how we see us like wolves, like living in a pack. Gugwes would not live like that. They'd be lone hunters.
Well,
Sasquatch, I believe, would be in actual family groups.
Well, and that brings up a question real quick, you know, because once again, Gugwe, colloquially meaning face eater, is that something, and are the stories the fact that Gugwe hunted man, or the fact of like you come across them and that will happen? You know, was it the fact, because that's something that we've talked about before, something that I've talked about before on the show with King Gerhard. I am not a proponent typically of the thinking that, you know, for instance, that Bigfoot's going to run down a 8-point buck and eat it. Mainly because that's just not something that a predator would typically do. You know, even though they're a predator, they're smart. You know, they're going to look for a sickly one. They're going to look for one that ain't in great shape. They're going to look for one that's straggling, that they can grab from the background, a baby or an elderly one, you know, something like that. More than likely though, much like any bear, like you're not going to see a bear taking down an elk. You know, and just like stalking an elk. Now, if they come across an elk that's fallen, will they predate it and will they eat it all day long and every scrumptious part that they can to get the vitamins and minerals that they need? You know, but typically they're going to be hunting smaller game. Like, I'd be sure. Would Bigfoot chase down a rabbit? Absolutely. Would Bigfoot snatch a squirrel off a tree as he's walking by? 1,000%. Because, yeah, I believe that they're omnivorous. But when it comes to taking large game, I think that they would much rather scavenge that than try to predate it, you know?
Yeah.
And when you're talking about a gugway or something like that, I think it would kind of go along the same sense, but go larger in size.
Yeah. Like, you know, for instance, I think areas where gugways are seen, white-tailed deer aren't in that area. But you do have moose, you have elk, you have much larger game. So that might cause these creatures to be a little bit larger and much more violent. Because think, so we have stories of Bigfoot hunting, like going after elk. But I can't think of any stories of Bigfoot going after moose. Because I don't think people realize how large moose are.
They're huge.
These are truly the kings of the forest when they're out there. But like, these gugries live in areas where these moose and things like that live. Maybe this will cause them to be much more hunting creatures than like the Sasquatch are. Because the original stories are very much of these creatures being very monstrous and very like actually hunting humans. Not that, like, oh, you came upon a gugwe and it killed you. No, it's it's going to look for you. It's going to hunt after you. Are these maybe caused by the fear of these creatures, or is it actual behavioral sets that the natives actually saw? It's very hard to tell because it's just a lack of research. Because, like, for instance, like, the gugwe has only been really brought up into our modern-day research in the past 10 or 15 years. So there's more research that goes into especially Native American tribes and the gugwe. But I think these creatures will be much more the consistent hunters than, like, what a Sasquatch is. Because, like, Sasquatch, I would be very much are much more of a scavenger, much more of a – if I need a hunt, it will go after, like, the sickly ones, the young ones. But I think the gugwe, at least how they're described as natives described them, would be the hunters that, like, oh, I'm going out, they're going to be the ones that go after the 8-point buck because that's how they're described as native traditions. But ecologically, does that make sense? Not very much. That's the stuff where we have to mix the old traditions of the native traditions and the modern day sciences of like primatology and ecology.
Yeah.
And see where that, where both of them marry.
Yeah. And, you know, that is, that's where, like we say on the show regularly, that is where these things are coming together, you know, and where we have to be ready for these fields to come together, Ryan. We've got to, because we've, Bigfoot research as we know it, Sasquatch research has only been going on since Patterson-Gimlin.
Yeah.
You know, so it is still, as far as a science goes, very young, but has garnered a lot of evidence in the time that it's been around. And there has been a windfall of such here in the last decade due to scientific advances and due to good people who were scientific in the way that they did things to begin with and who had backgrounds in science, folks like Jeffrey Meldrum, stuff like that, who took modern science and the applications of it and brought it to this field of study, and have married the two together. And it really is producing some great fruit. And there's going to be, I think, great things in the world of cryptozoology here in North America in the next decade. You know?
Yeah.
It's
I think due to the marriage of like science and old traditions and like things like anthropology is honestly how we will discover these creatures.
Yeah.
Like, it's kind of funny, like when you find people within the Sasquatch field, especially, they're like, well, science is going to find these creatures. There's going to be a bunch of people in the woods looking for them. Well, I'm like, how are you going to look for them without the science behind it? That's why, like with my research, I kind of say there's like two levels of research within cryptozoology. There's the baseline, the people that get the sightings, the people that get all the eyewitness accounts. There's the people that do the like, okay, what do these eyewitness counts mean? What's the science behind this? What can we learn from the data sets like that? Like I tell, like we tell our good friend Rod Nichols, I'm like, Rod, you go out there and you talk to eyewitnesses, you get the accounts. That's the part of really the science I don't really have down much because of just time and resources. But that's very much like, I think the first step of this research is talking to the eyewitnesses, getting the data. Then the next step is like, okay, what does the data mean? What can we speculate off this data? And then the next step would be like, okay, what can we formulate from there and get like how they do with like scientific journals and things like that, like going back and reanalyzing it multiple times and seeing what this can correlate to what we know in science, what we know in primatology, what we know in anthropology, what we know in zoology, and seeing what these correlates to with the actual natural sciences.
Well, absolutely. And, you know, the understanding, especially within science, but we need the common person needs to understand how science works and the idea that, A, science is not immutable. And the prime example I give of that regularly is in my bookshelf, I have my high school astronomy textbook that I made no less than a 98 on anything in. And in that textbook, it fully lists Pluto as a planet. Yeah. My son's astronomic chart of the solar system on his wall does not. And that's within my lifetime that Pluto became a planetesimal, not a planet. And when you look at things like, here's a CNN article that I posted the other day. Scientists have identified an estimated 10% of all species on Earth. 10%. Yeah. Have been identified to this day. That was yeah. literally like New Year's news. Like that came out like January 5th, 10th, something like that. So that is hot, fresh off the presses that we have identified 10% of living species. So when you start saying things like, you know, if Sasquatch existed, we would have found him by now. No, I'm sorry.
Even people that reference, like, oh, well, we find a fossil record of it. We'd find bones. Well, most paleontologists tell you, for every million bones, we find one.
Yeah.
And that's not even counting how hard it is to find that fossilization afterwards. We've only identified maybe not even 0.0001% of all fossils on this world in the first place.
Yeah.
So, like, when we bring up, like, fossilization and, like, how I haven't we found a body, of course we haven't found a body yet. It just it makes sense scientifically.
If and this is a horrible, horrible fact, folks, you get lost in the woods and they don't find you, the likelihood of ever being found is rough. What may happen is they may find a part of you. They may find a rib cage with a shirt still on it or something like that. They may find your backpack. But eventually what happens, and there's a great documentary on PBS. I want to say it's called Body Farm. Body Farm is the name of it. And it's about the farm in, I want to say it's Georgia, where they go and it's where they train police investigators to be able to identify a body. And like, it's how they know what the larval stage of a maggot looks like after 24 hours of being laid, after this long, because they literally put animals down and watch them decay. But they have to strap these animals down. Because even squirrels will come and even human bodies, will come take a finger. They'll come take an ear, things like that. Like that. This is where they actually got video footage of a deer scavenging a human carcass.
Yeah. People don't know, like, a lot of herbivores will eat meat every so often. Well, there's videos of deers eating live birds and stuff like that.
Well, and like, specifically they'll on scavenging, they'll eat the bones and things like that because of the minerals, you know, stuff like that. Rabbits will come chew the bones because if they don't chew something, their teeth will grow through their head, you know, stuff like that. So the fact that the reason it's why you don't find a full bear carcass all the time, or if you find a full deer carcass, you're pretty darn lucky, you know, because predation happens. Scavengers come by, vultures come, coyotes come, things get dragged apart and then they get torn apart, you know? So the idea of finding a full Sasquatch skeleton, We found very few full bear skeletons. Yeah. You know, most of them that we have or anything like that came from roadkill or donations from hunters.
Donations, yeah.
You know, so it's fascinating to think about that and to know that these creatures, Sasquatch, devil monkeys, Gugwey, like we've been talking about tonight, are something that are spoken about by native cultures. There's something that have been spoken about since prior to the arrival of Anglo or other culture in the area. So how do we, I guess, separate and sift, what has been added, you know, like you can't uncook a gumbo, can you, Ryan? You know, like once you've added too much salt, can you fix it? How do we begin to separate and sift the fact of native stories from the veneer of modern stuff that's been added to them?
Yeah. Well, one thing I look at is, like, for instance, correlations between, like, behavioral sets of, like, primates and, like, these cryptids. For instance, think of the Gugwey. It literally means face eater, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Chimpanzees, when they attack a human, what do they go after first? They go after the face. Most primates, when they attack you, they go after the face first. They go That's after right. anything they can go after. Fingers, toes, the face especially. So maybe these ideas of the face eater, maybe that could be indicative of a primate behavior. Even like with Sasquatch, people reference like the vocalizations, the rock throwing, stick throwing, that in modern perspectives we know is primate behavior.
Yeah.
So that those correlations are what I really try to look for the most in this research. And like correlations between like Bigfoot and zoology. That's why everyone asks me like, what's your favorite cryptid? I'm like, well, Bigfoot usually, because Sasquatch, there's so many correlations between the Sasquatch and actual known zoology, actual known yeah. biology, which is indicative of a living, breeding creature living out in the woods. That's like when we had the symposium. That's why I bring up like the dog man.
Yeah.
Not many correlations between the dog man and known zoology. That's what makes me think it's something totally different. But with the Gugwey, there are correlations between zoology and this Gugwey creature. That's what makes me think it's indicative of a living, breeding creature living in the woods. But a lot of these cryptids don't have that correlation, which causes me to think they have some type of other origin. What that origin is, I don't know. It could be ultra-terrestrial, interdimensional. It could be something other than it's living, breeding, and from evolving on this Earth.
Well, and you know, once again, it doesn't necessarily, and we got into this at the conference, especially with Dogman, especially with things like, we've got like maybe 10 minutes left here, Ryan, but it's wild to go into the concept of infrasound and yeah. ultrasound being used by animals, you know, and the way that that affects us. You know, I do a lot of work in the world of brainwave music, binaural beats, things like that. And it's fascinating the way that some frequencies affect the brain, you know, like 19 hertz. We see a very small terahertz range. But amongst that is what we hear, which is 20 hertz to 20,000 hertz. And 19 hertz, the range just below, one notch below where humans begin to hear, is where the water in our eye begins to vibrate.
Yes.
And where optical distortion and optical illusion begins, and where the feeling, it's known as the paranormal frequency, because it literally makes you feel as though there is something in the room watching you.
Yeah.
That you're no longer alone is what it makes you feel like. So the idea that if an animal like a Sasquatch or a Dogman, even if a Dogman exists but in a parallel dimension, if using those frequencies can affect us, then absolutely that thing in an adjunct space can vibrate the air or use that frequency and make us see through that space and see them as though they are right here in the woods with us, you know? That is a distinct possibility in the way that our brain works and in the way that frequencies work, you know? So the idea of a dog man existing in a parallel dimension that all they have to do is growl in a certain way to affect the space around them to...
Physically perceive it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like
to allow you to perceive, to vibrate your eyes so that you can see into that reality.
Yeah. And that brings in the question of like everything paranormal. Like I think a lot of paranormal aspects are frequency wise. Like,
absolutely.
Possibly these spirits and ghosts are another frequency higher or lower than us. And possibly some of these cryptids could be the same way.
Yeah.
It's like it brings in ideas of like, what if these frequencies change and alter? That's why we can perceive them,
and why like, they're there and then not there.
Yeah,
you know, why it's fascinating when you start digging into that side of it, you know,
yeah.
and the idea of something that we literally know happens from biology, from the world around us, and from zoology. You know, whales operate off of infrasound, elephants operate off of infrasound, lions communicate via infrasound.
Even gorillas. Like,
that's right.
Recently, we've discovered that gorillas can produce infrasound.
That's right.
And if that great ape can produce infrasound, why couldn't Sasquatch? Like, as of our knowledge, we don't believe humans can use infrasound. But that's something that we really haven't researched. What if we could possibly? Like, there's a lot of things when it comes to acoustic, like acoustic zoology and acoustic research that we just haven't really looked into a lot.
That's right. That's right. And once again, it's the fact of we've only classified 10%.
Yeah.
You know, and when you start looking, you want a really wild figure, just go Google how many species are discovered annually. And, yes. And it's almost on the order of 10,000. It's crazy. Yep. Even during COVID, there were numerous species that were classified. It's not like people were out in the field or something like that. It's the fact of the work was still going on. They could sit at home and classify images that they'd taken, all kinds of things. So these classifications came through. But even during the COVID pandemic, like 10,000 species were discovered and classified. So they're out there. They're out there. We have yet to explore much of our country, much of the countryside in our country, much of the terrain and even the water. So it's interesting to explore these possibilities and to consider the fact that there may be things like a Gugwey stalking in the woods of North America, you know, and it's interesting to think about that. Ryan, thank you so much as always for coming on, man. It's always a great conversation. We always go some interesting places. Let everybody know where they can go to get your books, where they can go to follow you on social media, all that kind of good stuff, my friend.
Of course. My books are available on Amazon.com, Cryptids of the World by Ryan Edwards, Sasquatch, a Prehistory of a Living Legend, and Beyond Bigfoot, the other unrecognized primates in North America. I am available on my Instagram and my Facebook, Ryan Edwards on Facebook, and redwards.crypto on Instagram. You can always reach out to me there. I'm always open to messages, things like that. If people have any interesting stories or just you guys like our conversations and you want to talk to me firsthand, I'm always open to a good conversation. So reach on out, go buy those books because there's a lot of good research in there and a lot of good things that people would never even heard of.
That's right.
Reading something like that.
That's right. Ryan, amazing work as always, man. Thank you so much for your time. I love your books. Everybody make sure to go out and grab those. Hold on real quick while we close out with the audience. While you are online, finding Ryan Edwards and following his work, make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. CuriousRealm.com is where you can like, follow, subscribe, share. That's where you can find all of our episodes. That's where you can go to CuriousRealm.com/store and buy all of the books from Ryan Edwards, as well as books and classes from our other guests. That's where you can also get your copy of the Curious Research Field Observation Field observation and encounter log. If you are a researcher in the world of cryptozoology, paranormal, UFO, UAP, and you are out in the field doing work, this is your official data guide that fits in your back pocket where you can write down experiences as they happen. You can take field notes, all kinds of things, and scientifically prepare your data to shake hands with science come the day that it needs to happen. Thank you so much, everybody, for tuning in tonight. Thank you so much for taking the time, as always, to be part of the community. It is your open hearts, your open minds that make the conversation. And without the conversation, humanity does not march forward. So remember, take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and stay curious. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of The Curious Realm. Stay tuned for more guests, forbidden topics, and hidden truths. Follow us on social media by searching Curious Realm. To download the official Curious Realm app and view the Knowledge Vault, or become a sponsor of Curious Realm, visit our website at CuriousRealm.com. Curious Realm is available on your favorite podcast and video services, CuriousRealm.com, as well as KGRA Radio, APR TV, and the official Curious Realm app for Roku devices. Curious Realm is a proud member of the Ground Zero Media and Aftermath Media family of podcasts. For more great shows and members-only content, visit aftermath.media today. Thanks for listening. Stay curious. And remember, the other side is always watching.